Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
In a Seattle courtroom today, prosecutors asked Judge Richard Jones to sentence Binance founder Zhangpeng Zhao to 3 years in prison for allowing rampant money laundering on the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange. Zhao's lawyers pleaded with the judge to spare him from prison. The judge gave neither side what they wanted, sentencing Zhao to 4 months in prison. CZ, as he's called, pleaded guilty in November to one count of failing to maintain an anti-money laundering program and stepped down as Binance agreed to pay $4.3 billion to settle related allegations. This closes a long-running probe for the Justice Department, which had wanted to make an example of Zhao in an industry rebounding from a slew of high-profile scandals. You remember Sam Bankman-Fried. Joining me from Seattle is Bloomberg legal reporter Ava Benny Morrison, who was in the courtroom for the sentencing. Set the scene for us, Ava.
Sure. So Zhangpeng Zhao, who's better known as CZ, turned up to the federal courthouse in Seattle just before 9 a.m. He had about half a dozen lawyers with him. He didn't say much throughout the proceeding other than getting up to give a statement to the judge where he talked about how remorseful he was, how he had made a mistake, but he took full responsibility. And that's why he had travelled from his home in the UAE to America at the end of last year to face the prosecution. While he was sitting at the table, he was very still, he was sitting up straight, he was staring at the judge, sort of seemed to be absorbing everything that the judge and the prosecutors were saying. CZ's mother and his sister Jessica were both seated in the front row, and there were a few other friends and supporters from the crypto industry that were in the courthouse as well.
There was a plea deal here, but prosecutors were asking for twice the sentencing guidelines. What was their reasoning?
Federal prosecutors were trying to make an example out of CZ. He was the CEO of the world's biggest crypto company, they argued, and he committed these crimes as part of a plan to violate US laws. That would allow him to make more money, allow big traders to continue using Binance, even though it didn't have an adequate anti-money laundering program. So they were arguing for 36 months in prison for CZ to really send a message, not only to the crypto industry, but to corporate leaders far and wide, that this sort of behavior would not be tolerated and would be punished.
As you mentioned, the defense was asking for leniency and probation. What was their argument?
The defense was pleading with the judge to spare CZ from prison. They pointed to the fact that he voluntarily came back to America to face these charges at the end of last year. They said that he had cooperated extensively with the government in this investigation and that he directed Binance to cooperate with the DOJ as well. They pointed out that Binance had settled several investigations with not only the DOJ, but the CFTC, the Treasury Department, which resulted in the company paying $4.3 billion worth of fines. I think the biggest sticking point in the arguments today was over whether a prison sentence was warranted for this type of offence. CZ was essentially charged with violating the Bank Secrecy Act, which sounds pretty minor on the face of it, but attached to that crime were some arguably pretty serious circumstances because he didn't have an adequate AML program at Binance. Terrorist organisations like Al-Qaeda and Hamas were able to trade on the platform, and US customers were trading with customers in sanctioned countries like Iran. So the defence was really trying to narrow in on the fact that this was just a banking violation, but the prosecution was urging the judge to look at those serious circumstances that were attached to it.
Did the prosecution say or prove in any way that CZ knew about what was happening on the platform, you know, like the terrorist organizations trading?
No, the prosecution didn't say that CZ personally knew that there were the proceeds of crime moving across Binance. And the defense really highlighted that as well, saying, look, there is no evidence here that CZ personally, as the CEO of the company, knew that illicit funds were moving across Binance. And so that needed to be taken into account.
How long did his statement to the judge last, and what part of it stood out to you?
CZ's statement to the judge only lasted a few minutes. He started by saying that he was remorseful and he was sorry and he had made mistakes. He spoke about how difficult it was for him to step down as CEO of Binance, a company that he founded in China several years ago. He spoke about how he struggled to accept that that was essentially the only course of action here. But he spoke about how he still wants to make a difference in the world and he's really focused on some philanthropy now that he's not leading Binance.
And it wasn't just what the prosecution asked for and the defense asked for. Tell us about the other recommendations.
There was such a big gap here between what each of the parties were recommending. The prosecution wanted 36 months. Probation and pretrial services had recommended only 5 months. And then, of course, CZ's defense team was asking for only probation. And the federal sentencing guidelines were between 12 and 18 months. So there was a lot of discrepancy there that the judge had to navigate.
And so tell us about, you know, what the judge said before he sentenced him.
The judge agreed with the defense that the prosecution's suggestion that CZ should be sentenced to 36 months in prison was far too high. He said that he had taken a lot of time to read through more than 160 letters submitted from CZ's friends and family and co-workers that painted this man in a very favourable light, describing him as a family man, a humble person, and just a hard-working entrepreneur. He said that, yes, while this is a Bank Secrecy Act violation and other cases involving that charge had resulted in probation, there were some egregious factors here, like the fact that Hamas and cyber criminals and dark web transactions were able to take place on the platform because of it. I think he just couldn't get past the Hamas, Al-Qaeda, dark web element of this. I will say that it's unusual for BSA cases to result in prison time, so the judge was really sort of putting his neck out here by handing down a sentence that did involve prison time. It'll be interesting to see if this sets a precedent for other BSA cases in white-collar prosecutions in the future.
What always seems striking to me about this case is that the UAE has no extradition treaty with the U.S., yet he flew here and turned himself in, and then prosecutors stopped him from returning home pending sentence. Did anyone mention that this whole scenario might stop other people from turning themselves in the future?
Yes, the defense actually did make a point out of that, saying CZ has done all the right things here. He's come back from Dubai, turned himself in, pleaded guilty to the charge, agreed to pay personally a $50 million fine to the government. He has ticked all the boxes, but the fact that the prosecution was then arguing for a prison sentence that was well above the federal sentencing guidelines might actually deter people from doing that in the future and from deciding to travel from a non-extradition country to the US to face the charges.
Ava, was there a feeling going in as to what he might get? I mean, did anyone think, you know, that he would walk out of there without any prison time?
I think he was certainly hoping that, but there really was a feeling in the courtroom that this could go either way. There could either be a very small amount of prison time or no prison time at all. You could tell that his lawyers had really prepared their arguments and were putting in a pretty tough fight to try and keep him out of prison. But the judge, in the end, was persuaded by the prosecution's argument that this just wasn't a run-of-the-mill Bank Secrecy Act case. This behaviour, this crime, allowed illicit actors to launder money and use Binance when they shouldn't have been able to do that.
What happens now? Do I understand that he's not eligible to go to a minimum security prison?
Yes. CZ, because he's not a U.S. citizen, isn't eligible for a minimum security prison. And that's usually where white-collar defendants end up. So he has made a request to the judge to be designated to a facility called FDC CTAC here in Seattle. We don't know when he needs to turn up and start that prison sentence. That date's still to be decided, but he will spend 4 months there. His lawyer did say that he's eager to just get it over and done with and finally be able to return to Dubai to reunite with his family. CZ and his lawyers are waiting to hear from probation to decide on an appropriate date for him to turn up to the prison and start his four-month sentence.
This is the second high-profile sentencing in the crypto industry recently. Was Sam Bankman-Fried mentioned at all?
Sam Bankman-Fried did get a mention, actually, when the prosecutor was referring to the arguments that CZ's lawyers had submitted to the court. He said, look, we're not alleging that CZ is a Sam Bankman-Fried. We're not saying that he's a monster and we're not trying to kill the crypto industry. But we are saying that this is a serious crime because he didn't have an AML program and that allowed some of these illicit actors and terrorists to gain access to Binance.
Thanks so much, Ava. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Ava Benny Morrison. Zhao will enter the history books as the richest person ever to do time in U.S. federal lockup. His ownership of Binance and an estimated $43 billion personal fortune tied to it remain intact, and his wealth is likely to grow even more as Binance's business accelerates amid crypto's latest bull run. In fact, his wealth ballooned by $25 billion as the crypto industry recovered last year, and he's currently ranked as the 38th richest person in the world, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. And despite having to relinquish the chief executive title as part of his deal with the government, his influence on the company is hard to miss. Its new board of directors is dominated by his devoted friends, and the mother of three of his children plays a major role in running its operations. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, the FTC has banned non-compete clauses which prevent workers from transferring to other companies in the same industry. However, companies may not have to rush to comply with that FTC non-compete ban. We'll tell you why. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
The Federal Trade Commission's rule banning most non-compete clauses that prohibit workers from switching jobs within an industry is scheduled to take effect 120 days from its publication on April 23rd. However, standing in the way are lawsuits by the Chamber of Commerce and others seeking to block the rule, arguing the FTC doesn't have the authority to issue it. And a judge could issue a preliminary injunction stopping the rule from going into effect while the litigation proceeds. Joining me is Kimberly Carson, a partner at Quinn Emanuel and an expert on non-competes. Tell us about this near total ban on non-competes.
Sure. So last week, the Federal Trade Commission issued a rule banning non-competes nationwide. The rule essentially prohibits employers from doing three things after the effective date. One, enforcing existing non-competes with workers. Two, entering into new non-competes with workers. And three, representing that workers are subject to non-compete clauses. The rule also has a notice requirement that essentially requires employers to give notice by the rule's effective date to every effective worker who's bound by an existing non-compete that the non-compete won't be enforced in the future.
Is this ban expected to have a widespread effect on the workforce?
Yes, certainly. If you read the FTC's rule and the accompanying guidance, the FTC's intention is for it to apply to all workers, including employees, independent contractors, externs, interns, volunteers, really anyone who works for someone, whether paid or unpaid, with certain limited exceptions. And the rule is also intended to apply to all employers, regardless of size, regardless of whether they're private or public, really all people, partnerships, and companies that are within the FTC's jurisdiction. While there's an exception for senior executives with existing non-competes, the FTC estimates that that will apply to less than 1% of workers.
President Biden and the Biden administration has been pushing for non-competes, and we've heard a lot about the positive effects. I mean, what are the downsides of this ban?
I think there's a lot of concern at the business level about how companies can continue to protect trade secrets, client goodwill, employee goodwill, their investment in human capital in the absence of non-compete. So that's certainly a concern. And you see that reference in the handful of legal challenges that have been filed to the rule so far, including by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. There are, of course, other contractual and legal mechanisms to protect those sorts of interests. And the FTC itself pointed out some of them. And so that's what a lot of the discussion and focus has been at the business level that I've been seeing.
You mentioned the lawsuit. The Chamber of Commerce and other business groups are suing. Explain the grounds for their lawsuit.
So the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has filed a lawsuit in federal court in Texas challenging the rule. They're asking the court to issue an order staying the rule's effective date, enjoining the FTC's enforcement of the rule, or both. And they've raised various arguments in support, including that the non-compete exceeds the FTC's statutory authority. They've argued that the FTC doesn't have the authority to prohibit unfair methods of competition through rulemaking. They've also argued that the rule is unlawfully retroactive. And they've also taken issue with the evidence that the FTC has cited in support of the rule. The retroactivity point is interesting. I've seen as an employment litigator and advisor to companies that are looking at what this rule means for their business, a lot of discussion and focus on the retroactivity point. I will say that the rule, once effective, will apply not only to future non-competes, but also non-competes already in existence as of the effective date. The rule says that pretty expressly. There is, however, an express carve-out for claims that accrued before the effective date of the rule. So what that means is if an employer is alleging that a worker accepted employment in breach of a non-compete and the breach occurred before the effective date of the rule, that will be outside the scope of the rule. And because of that carve-out, the FTC has said in the rulemaking guidance that they think that the rule is not impermissibly retroactive, but you know, business groups and the Chamber of Commerce disagree.
Is this a strong challenge to the ban?
From what I've seen, a lot of practitioners in the space anticipate that there could be a stay or injunction of the rule pending these lawsuits, including the Chamber of Commerce's challenge, which could delay the rollout and timeline of compliance for the rule.
I want to talk more about the rule. You know, we've had a story on Bloomberg that Wall Street traders and money managers could be in for disappointment if they're hoping that this rule will clear the way for them to go to higher paying competitors. Tell us about garden leaves.
So there is express language in the rule that says that the rule does not apply to garden leave agreements. A garden leave agreement is essentially an agreement whereby the worker is still employed and still being paid for some period after they've given notice of resignation. So during that period, they're still an employee, they're still getting paid, they still have contractual and fiduciary duties. And the FTC has advised that that type of garden leave agreement is not an impermissible non-compete under the rule. And that's because non-competes really govern the period after your employment ends, whereas a garden leave agreement is not a post-employment restriction. That is a period where you're still an employee. So for the bankers out there, to the extent their employer is covered and under FTC jurisdiction, and they're looking at garden leave arrangements, those are expressly outside the scope of the non-compete ban.
Have garden leaves been litigated? Because it does seem like it's preventing a worker from going somewhere else.
You know, it's an interesting question. It doesn't come up a lot. I do a lot of restrictive covenant litigation all over the country. And contractual notice of termination periods, where you have to say, you know, give 60 or 90 day notice that you're leaving, or garden leave agreements where, you know, your termination, your resignation is not effective for some period, those are not often litigated. I think there's a notion of fairness because employees are being paid to sit on the beach for that period and essentially cooperate with transition requirements. So those aren't litigated as frequently as post-employment restrictions. That said, I think that, you know, if an employee is inclined to say, I want my resignation to be effective immediately, I'm not going to accept compensation for my notice period or my garden leave period, I want to get immediately to work, that could be an interesting question for adjudication by a court. But that doesn't come up very often in my practice.
So, yeah, they're paid to sit on the beach, not paid to sit in the garden. This name seems a little bit odd to me.
Yeah.
Do you know where that name came from?
My understanding has always been that it's a British concept.
Okay. All right. They're sitting in the garden and we're sitting on the beach. All right.
Yeah.
So this is a national ban by the FTC. Some states also have bans. I mean, do a lot of states have bans on non-competes?
A lot of states have restrictive covenant statutes, and that trend has been increasing over the years. Obviously, when you think about state bans, the first state that comes to mind is California. Mm-hmm. They have probably the strongest language in their various statutes restricting post-employment restrictions. But there are several other states that are relatively hostile to enforcing restrictive covenants. And then there are many other states that have some limits on restrictive covenants. For example, you know, states might ban them for low-wage workers. In terms of how this rule interacts with state statutes and regulations, the rule doesn't limit or affect enforcement of state laws that restrict non-competes where those state laws don't conflict with the rule. However, if state laws do conflict, so for example, state laws permit non-competes, then the FTC's rule would preempt them.
Some have predicted that the FTC's nationwide ban will spur more states to pass laws limiting restrictive covenants. I mean, do you think that's likely? If there's a federal ban, why would the states need their own bans?
I think that's right. I think states would only need to have legislation to the extent they're interested in even broader restrictions than the FTC ban. The FTC ban on its face is pretty broad. I think that over the last few years, you have seen growing interest at the state level in restrictive covenant limits. And this national rule that was proposed over a year ago has certainly, I think, changed the tone of that discourse. That said, given the various legal challenges to the FTC's rule and uncertainty about when it will go into effect and whether it will be stayed or enjoined by a court, could still, you know, inspire states to take their own actions with respect to restrictive covenant limits or bans.
So employers in states that don't have these bans in place, do they have some time now, sort of like an interim time, to still leave the non-competes in and see what happens?
Yeah, so the rule is not effective yet. The rule says that it will become effective 120 days after it's published in the Federal Register. So as of now, it's not likely to take effect before September 2024. That means compliance isn't required until at the earliest September 2024. And as discussed, that deadline could get pushed as a result of court challenges. So in the meantime, you know, companies do have time right now to assess the rule, talk to lawyers about what it does and doesn't require, consider how the rule might impact their business, do an assessment of workers with non-competes, workers that may or may not fall in the senior executive exception, and really start to plan for how they want to handle this going forward, how they might notify workers when and if it becomes effective, whether they might want to incorporate alternative contractual mechanisms in their contracts with employees to protect trade secrets. Those are all things that I think employers should be thinking about right now as we approach the effective date over the summer.
And we'll be watching to see if that judge in Texas issues a preliminary injunction stopping the rule from going into effect until the litigation is complete. Thanks so much, Kim. That's Kimberly Carson, a partner at Quinn Emanuel. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
The jury in Donald Trump's hush money trial heard the most vivid testimony yet about payments to silence a former Playboy playmate and an adult film star before the 2016 election. Both claimed to have had affairs with the billionaire developer. Los Angeles attorney Keith Davidson took the witness stand to recount how he represented the former playmate, Karen McDougal, who was paid $150,000, and Stormy Daniels, who got $130,000 to keep quiet. Before Davidson took the stand, Judge Juan Merchan fined the former president $1,000 for each of 9 violations of the gag order. He said, "Defendant is hereby warned that the court will not tolerate continued willful violations of its lawful orders, and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment." Trump's use of social media, news interviews, and campaign speeches has created a challenge for judges overseeing his many legal cases as they weigh the impact of his public comments on the proceedings against his free speech rights. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado, who's covering the trial for us. Pat, tell us about the judges fining Trump $9,000 and warning him about prison time.
Judge Merchan has had a pending request from the district attorney to basically fine Trump in contempt for repeatedly violating his gag order. And today, Judge Merchan found that 9 violations of the gag by making comments about Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen, who are both the proposed key prosecution witnesses against him, commenting about them, commenting on their veracity, making comments about David Pecker, the former basically publisher of National Enquirer, saying he was a good candidate. He was basically finding he's repeatedly violated it. But in the meantime, the DA's asked for 4 additional penalties that Trump has additionally violated. So there's another contempt hearing on Thursday about this. So Trump's been fined $9,000, and the judge is warning him he better behave or he could face possible jailing.
And as far as fines, that's the maximum the judge can impose.
It's a maximum $1,000 per fine. So that's under the statute, the max the judge can impose. But on the other side, what the judge has warned Trump, he wants to balance his rights to speak freely and his First Amendment rights as he campaigns to return to the White House. But he also wants to make sure that Trump doesn't impair and, you know, impact the trial.
So now the first witness on the stand today was on the stand Friday, Michael Cohen's ex-banker. Tell us what his testimony was about.
His testimony is basically setting up how these transfers happened and how does Stormy Daniels get paid off. The story, the DA alleges that Michael Cohen paid her. He took out a home equity line of credit, funded this LLC he created, and then paid her off, Stormy off the $130,000 on his own. Prior payments were made, if you remember, by AMI, and National Enquirer had paid off Karen McDougal. And a doorman, a Trump Tower doorman, had been paid off as well by AMI. But this time, David Pecker had refused. So now we get to the stage of the paper trail tying Cohen to the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. And we see how the banker said that the accounts were created, you know, he was already Michael Cohen's banker, and that Michael Cohen calls him in a frantic that he needs to set up this new LLC, comes up with alternative names, funds it, and then makes the money payment.
On cross-examination, was the defense trying to show that Trump had nothing to do with this?
Well, so that's not the story. The story is that Michael Cohen pays this. And so the DA has never alleged that Michael Cohen is doing this out of the goodness of his own heart, and that neither did the U.S. attorneys in the Southern District of New York when Michael Cohen pled guilty to campaign finance violations. He wasn't doing that out of his goodness of his own heart. He was making these payments on Donald Trump's behalf. That's what the DA says, and that's what Michael Cohen says. You see him paying. I mean, it's not Stormy Daniels is not his to silence. It's Donald Trump's trouble.
So what did the defense try to do on cross?
Well, the defense was trying to ask these questions that made it seem like Donald Trump had nothing to do with this. And yes, that's true, but that's only half the story. The DA doesn't allege that. The DA doesn't allege that the bank that provided these loans was Donald Trump's account. No, this is not Donald Trump's banker. It's not his bank account. The money didn't come from these accounts. Michael Cohen and the DA says the money came from Michael Cohen because Trump wanted him to pay it.
Okay.
And we can expect Michael Cohen to take the stand and describe it this way. So what we heard later today was a very interesting witness. He's probably the most compelling. This guy is Keith Davidson. He's an L.A. lawyer who represented not only Stormy Daniels, but also Karen McDougal. So we hear from his perspective of he's the lawyer. He's got a hot story. He called it a blockbuster story that was worth selling. And they were going to try to sell Stormy Daniels' story, and then it comes up that they try to get it sold. So first you have Karen McDougal's story, and he's negotiating with Trump, but he's also talking to ABC News. Karen McDougal, the former Playboy model, wanted to keep it quiet. She had said she had an intimate sexual relationship, she claimed, with Trump, and so they were talking about possibly selling it to ABC News, but she said she didn't want to be the scarlet letter woman. She didn't want to be like, you know, Monica Lewinsky, branded as a harlot. So she would rather keep it quiet. So she agreed to keep it quiet for the hush money payment, which she got.
And tell us about this sort of side story.
This is in June 2016. And then suddenly comes this alert that there's another woman. And Keith Davidson said he had talked to Michael Cohen way back in 2011, because Michael Cohen had called him up and demanded there was some kind of website, and they had published this anonymous story saying that Donald Trump had had an affair with this porn star named Stormy Daniels. And Cohen called Davidson up and said, I'm threatening you right now, and you better take, he was accusing Stormy of being the source of this story. Keith Davidson says he wrote a cease and desist letter to the website saying, take that story down. And they did. And then here we are 5 years later. It's now July, August, September, and the Stormy Daniels story was burbling along. And then, boom, the Access Hollywood tape comes out. And that's when suddenly Davidson says there's a whole new focus on this story getting hot all over again, and Stormy's story could get out. So suddenly the Trump campaign and Cohen started calling him. There were negotiations that went on between Keith Davidson, the lawyer representing Stormy, AMI, and the editor's name is Dylan Howard, and then Michael Cohen. And you could see Dylan Howard and Keith Davidson had worked together on other stories in the past. He represented a lot of celebrity clients. So he gets reached out to, and they start negotiating a deal. But then it becomes unclear who's going to pay for Stormy's story. And that's when Michael Cohen comes in, and there's some discussions about how she's going to get paid. And there was a deal worked out where it was basically an agreement between Cohen and Davidson that Cohen and Trump would buy the story, that Trump was going to buy this story from Stormy Daniels, keep her quiet. But then it turns out...
And the lawyer testified about how he started to get frustrated with the whole thing?
Keith Davidson started getting very frustrated because he said he started getting the runaround from Michael Cohen, that there was no money, there was no money, there was no money. And he kept saying, it's Yom Kippur, I can't pay you. And send me your wire information so I can transfer you the funds. And September goes into October, and it's still getting the runaround. Eventually, Keith Davidson begins to think that maybe Trump was tight with his money. And Cohen didn't have the authority. He said, the entire matter was very frustrating to me, and that it was on again and off again, and there were cancellations and disengaging from clients and reengaging with clients. Dylan, meaning Dylan Howard of the National Enquirer, said he reached out to Pecker, who's the publisher of the National Enquirer, and that everything was teed up. He's basically telling me to call Cohen, and Cohen says, I'm not paying anything. AMI is paying. It was just one more snafu. So eventually, Davidson confronts Cohen, and there's more discussion. He called Cohen highly excitable, sort of a pants on fire kind of guy. And he said he had a lot of things going on. He had two phones and talking out of each of his two ears, sort of like that movie Up, where the dog says, squirrel, squirrel. So that Michael Cohen was this excitable character, and that Michael Cohen had promised that, don't worry, Trump's going to come clean. And there's basically a discussion between Dylan Howard, the National Enquirer editor, and Davidson, the lawyer for Stormy, basically, like, they can't understand. I can't use the words, but their blue language, he effed it up. And why was this? And that was a discussion that Trump was tight with money, that they had the seal on a silver platter, and it was there for the taking, and the only reason it didn't close was because they didn't want to fund it, and the only reason they didn't fund it is they didn't want to spend the money.
I'm sure this testimony kept the jurors' attention. And tomorrow he'll be back on the stand. Thanks so much, Pat. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.